Hello, everybody. Welcome to this episode of What's Next. I am your host, Tiffany Bova, and I have the wonderful pleasure of welcoming Mike Maples to the show. He is a co-founding partner at Floodgate. He has been on the Forbes Midas list 8 times in the last decade and was also named a rising star by Fortune and profiled by Harvard Business School for his lifetime contributions to entrepreneurship. Before becoming a full-time investor, Mike was involved as a founder and operating executive at back-to-back startup IPOs, including Tivoli Systems, which was acquired by IBM, where his dad used to work, and Motive, acquired by Alcatel-Lucent. Some of Mike's investments include Twitter, Clover Health, Okta, Outreach, Chegg, Demand Force, and Applied Intuition. And he has a new book out called Pattern Breakers with his co-author, Peter Zibelman. So welcome to the show, Mike.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm super excited to talk to you and dig into becoming an entrepreneur and being one so early in the dot-com evolution. But before we do that, I would be remiss if I did not start us off without going into bullish and bearish.
Okay.
Bullish, you are for it. Bearish, you are against it. Funny saying that to a VC. You know better than I the difference between the two. But let's go with the first one. High-speed train tunnel from New York to London.
Hey, I'm down. I'm bullish.
I am too. I don't know if I would get in it, but I'm all for it for people who want to like sit in that tube. That's a long way to go. Long way to go. I even feel nervous between London and Paris when you have to go under for like 20 minutes. Yeah, I don't know about hours.
Yeah, I look at it like we don't build enough ambitious things, particularly in the world of atoms in our society. And, we used to decide we were going to have a transcontinental railroad and we would have people with pickaxes digging holes and tunnels into mountains in the 1800s. And I'm not sure that we could lay tracks as fast now as we did back then, but a lot of it is just a choice that you make about whether you believe you should do it and whether you should build things quickly and whether you should build ambitious things. And I think we've lost a little bit of that since around 1970. You know, there aren't any new nuclear power plants in the U.S. It takes longer to do a cross-country flight in the U.S. than it did in 1970 because you got security. And so, you know, I want to see supersonic jets and I want to see tunnels, you know, under the ocean. And hey, why not? Let's go.
Well, that leads me to my next one, flying taxis, bullish or bearish?
Bullish, heck yeah.
All right. And the third one, AI-led VC firm.
I'm bullish on that too. And so, I've done a lot of experiments with AI and it's very interesting. So you might think that I would feel threatened by AI, but what is actually true is that AI lets an individual person implement superpowers. And so, you know, if you're a developer, what used to take an entire team to develop, now sometimes a single person can develop. Same is true in marketing and lots of these other areas. And so I have this tiny little organization with like 10 people, and a lot of venture firms have hundreds of people. And I believe that AI is going to allow small teams to force multiply and amplify, and it's going to be incredibly powerful what you can do. There are things that I've been doing with AI lately that I couldn't have dreamt of doing a couple of years ago.
That sort of leads me to something that you hold dear when it comes to the venture business. Like, you know, you have a lot of opinions about it, which we'll get into, but one of them is this sort of process of elimination. And this are your words. You say that 99 business plans out of 100 that you get are linear in their thinking rather than exponential in their thinking. And so you eliminate those quite quickly. And so when you think about AI in the VC world, are you thinking about that entry point of, hey, well, I get hundreds, if not thousands, I'm sure you get pitched all the time and you can't read them all. So Is it kind of like that use case of let me run them through with my parameters and see what comes out the other side?
You can do some of that. And so one of the things I've been experimenting with is a program that would, but it's really more to help the founder. So imagine, you know, there's ideas in my Pattern Breakers book about inflections and insights and ideas from the future. It would be interesting if you could just upload your business plan and it could give you a report on here's how powerful I think your inflections are, what they are. Here's how powerful I think your insight is. Here's what I would think of as like weaknesses or ways to present it better or to execute better. And if we could do that, I think it would help founders. It, I mean, it might help me evaluate pitches, but really what I care about is having the idea spread for the founders wanting to build their companies. And so that's pretty interesting to me. But like the thing that it gives me superpowers in is, for example, I have a list of all the startups where you would have made more than 100 times your money in the last 20 years. And so now I can look at those startups and I can say, here's 9 types of business models. What was the primary business model of each type? You know, what do a business model canvas for each one. Tell me what Clay Christensen jobs to be done were for each one. How fast do they get to 10 million in revenue? How fast do they get to 100 million in revenue? And I could have never dreamed of doing those things. I couldn't have hired even a team to do those things. But now I'm just sitting there at a chat interface. And so if you have specific knowledge that you've built over many decades and you can combine it with the cognitive automation of AI, that's where I think the magic is. You know, somebody who doesn't know anything about seed investing isn't going to get that much benefit. But if you have a sort of this lattice of mental models around seed investing, you can get massive benefit. You can do things you could have never dreamed of doing before.
And I think that that's requires also a level of rigor. So, you know, if you're listening to this discussion, right, this is a masterclass from Mike on, if you have a startup idea, what would somebody like Mike look for, right? Is it that business case? Is it the, how does it actually fit? Is there market product fit? You know, is it an exponential or a finite view on something? Is it, you know, like sort of those kinds of questions. And I wonder, because you've done that exercise, was there a few common threads of companies that surprised you, that if you had looked with the naked eye, you would have been like, oh, absolutely not. And then they ended up really nailing it, or vice versa.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, and I should caveat all of this, you know, there's that movie with Liam Neeson where he says at the beginning, I got a particular set of skills. So I have a particular set of skills in business, but by extension, there's a bunch of things I don't know about as well, and where my knowledge is probably not as applicable. So I'm looking for the 0.1% of startups that create 90% of the outcomes in venture capital. So like, I am not in a normal business. You know, our distributions are not normal. You know, they follow the power law, and I'm looking for a capitalist mutation, right? I'm not looking for something that's normal. So why is that important? Well, the great startups I've found, what really jumps out at me is they're just radically different. You know, they can't be compared with anything that's ever come before. And so I like to say that a great startup has to force a choice and not a comparison. And the reason for that is that if a startup can be compared to what's known, why would you buy from a startup? Why would you buy from a company that's 80% likely to go out of business if you have any reasonable alternative? You won't, right? So like the startup needs to show up seemingly out of nowhere with just something radically empowering that's never been seen before. And it's the first time it's ever happened. And people are like, whoa, where have you been all my life? That's the thing that I find is interesting. And like a lot of these startups, not everybody likes them. In fact, maybe most people dislike them at first, but a small set of people just absolutely are overwhelmingly in love with what they're doing. And so an example that may resonate with you and some of the listeners that's not even in startups, but it illustrates it really well, is the Tesla Cybertruck. So I don't know, Tiffany, if you like the Tesla Cybertruck. I don't know if you want one. I don't know if you've bought one already. I don't know. What do you think about the Cybertruck?
I'm not a fan of it visually.
Okay.
I'm not a fan of it visually.
Fair enough, right? And like a lot of people I know don't just not really like it. They think it's ridiculous, right? And it's like, you may like it, you may dislike it, you may think it's ridiculous. But one thing that I think is true is that nobody ever says, how does that compare to a Ford F-150, right? Like, you know, Elon is basically saying, live in my future or don't. But you know, you can't reconcile a Cybertruck with a Ford F-150 or GMC Yukon or any of the Silverado or any of these other products. And so for better or worse, the Cybertruck escapes the comparison trap. And by doing so, everybody who values the advantage of the Cybertruck has no alternative but the Cybertruck, right? If you're hot for the Cybertruck, it's the only game in town. And so the best startups that I've worked with have that quality initially, where most people kind of don't like the idea because it's too weird and it makes them uncomfortable and it's just too unsettling compared to what they're used to. But a small number of people are like, oh my gosh, I've seen the truth. I've seen the future. This is amazing. I can't unsee it. And those early believers become co-conspirators with the startup and they co-create the future with the founders of those startups. And that's the mechanism for how these radical changes happen.
Personally, I think there's a couple of things in that comparison, right? You're right. Cybertruck doesn't have any comparisons, if you will. If you're just talking fully electric, you know, the Ford F, the Lightning, right? On the Ford side, it is really a truck, where cyber is not. The classic definition of a truck with a truck bed and a, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, you may call it a truck, but like in the classic definition of a truck, any other brand of automaker would not call that a truck.
Right? That's the beauty of it.
Right? That's one. Two, if you said, well, I am totally aligned with the Lightning, or I'm totally aligned with the leader at Ford.
Yep.
Where is the Cybertruck the allure of the whole thing, right? Yeah. To your point, like you're bought into the whole come to the future across the entire landscape of everything that particular founder has, right? Versus, you know, a Lightning is associated with Ford and an owner is aligned to it as a brand, but maybe not the person or the people.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think the other thing that I've learned, and you illustrate really well, is that people don't buy from startups for utility-oriented reasons or even practical reasons. They're animated by belief. So they buy because they believe what you believe. And it's those early believers who start new movements that change the future, right? So early believers moving to a different future start out as heretics and outcasts and mavericks. But over time, people start to say, hey, wait a second, these people are onto something. And then more and more people start to join the movement. And pretty soon, the bias is to be part of the new thing rather than the pre-existing thing. But it plays out over time, right? It doesn't happen overnight. And there's kind of an adoption life cycle of these ideas, where you have early believers who take the risk, and then you have, you know, more practical early majority people later, and then eventually laggards.
Yeah, for me, I always lean back into jobs to be done. You mentioned it with Clay, you know, and for me, it's like the job remains the same. It's the solution that changes. I'm oversimplifying.
Yeah.
But so if you say, like, one of the examples I really enjoyed, which I'd love for you to share, is your Twitter story, right? In the fact that you were an early investor at Twitter, but when you were having a conversation about Twitter, you know, it's kind of like, wait, what are you doing? And what are you trying to accomplish? And so I want you to tell that in a second. But the goal here is it's communication, right? Or it's transportation, or it's, you know, so Uber, it's reimagined of a taxi, of a car, of a whatever, right? But it's like, how does, because of technology, how does the solution change? Or with Twitter, it was communication, fast communication. It, you know, used to be, you know, Western Union, and then it was this, and then it was a phone call, and then it was email, and now it was this thing called, I'm going to tweet it, right?
Yeah.
And so that sort of always going back to, in my mind, of the job to be done and how technology has allowed us to change the solution. And if you're very good at that first principle thinking, and you're allowed to say, oh, or you're able to say, I have infinite understanding of where I think this is going to go, it may or may not work. But I think the Twitter story is a great one, if you wouldn't mind sharing it.
Sure. So this was a little bit of I grew up in Oklahoma, and, you know, we had an expression, a forward fumble, when something goes your way that you didn't expect necessarily. So I'd invested in a podcasting company called Odeo that Evan Williams ran. And Evan was already a well-known entrepreneur because he had started Blogger. And so I thought he was well suited to do podcasting. Well, a week after we invest, Apple decides to give podcasting away on iTunes, which at the time in 2005 means you're out of business, because Apple, all the devices at the time were iPods, and Apple's giving away the podcasting software. And so, like, there's no more reason for us to have a business. So Evan Williams decided to try to figure something out. We couldn't. And so after about a year and a half, he said, look, I'm just going to give everybody their money back. And, you know, that's not usually how it happens. You know, usually you just lose your money, because venture capital, it's an adventure, and you win some, you lose some. So I was like, look, Ev, you don't owe me anything. You know, you win some, you lose some. And he goes, well, some of my investors are kind of disenchanted, so I'm just going to give everybody their money back. It'd be easier for me if you just take it. And I said, well, can you tell me, I just want to invest in whatever your next thing is then. I don't care what it is. And he says, well, I am working on this project internally, and we're deciding whether to call it TWTTR or Voicemail 2.0. And I say, well, what does it do? And he goes, you say what you're doing. And I'm like, okay, yeah, then what happens after that? And he goes, that's it. Oh, I forgot. It, you say it in 140 characters or less, because, you know, we want to use it on cell phones for messaging. And I said, okay, what's the revenue model? And he says, there is no revenue model. And I'm like, well, what is the roadmap? There is no roadmap. And so I was like, well, you know, why do you think this is a business at all? Why do you even think this is a product? And he says, oh, I have no idea. But I figured that a million people wrote blogs when I did Blogger. But podcasting, it's a little bit harder. You got to upload the audio. You've got to make sure it works. You got to get the RSS feeds working, all this other stuff. I think it'd be good if I just overcorrected in the other direction. I think that if you made it really easy for people to express their ideas, maybe 10 million people would tweet. If that's true, then the burden of proof will be on the people who are negative. And so I was like, okay, I want to invest in Twitter, Voicemail 2.0, whatever it is. And he said, well, there's nothing to invest in right now. There's not a company. But about 9 months later, South by Southwest happened and they blew up at South by. And I thought, oh man, I'm probably not even going to get into this deal now. It's become a thing. It's becoming a phenomenon. And then one day Ev calls me up and says, hey, did you mean it when you said you wanted to invest in Twitter? Well, if that's true, now's the time. And so that's how I invested in Twitter. And, you know, for the next few years, there was the fail whale and couldn't decide who the CEO was. And, you know, there's all kinds of, you know, ebbs and flows and speed bumps along the way, but it just didn't matter. It was a great idea, right time.
Yeah. And if you think about that, like the, just the whole conversation, I don't know, I have this idea, not sure what we're going to call it. Well, and if you back up the why in what you were just saying is, well, I figure if people did this with me with blogging, this is just a sort of form of that. And because technology, now it's cell phones, like if you didn't have cell phones, smartphones, Twitter wouldn't work.
That's right.
And if you didn't have cell phones, Uber wouldn't work and Airbnb wouldn't work. And I mean, you know what I mean? Like and Instagram wouldn't work. Don't do those things like on your desktop. You do it on that smartphone, right? And so you could tweet off a desktop, obviously. But if not everything, like Instagram is not as user friendly. It's very difficult to do that on a desktop. But if you think through the Twitter example, he's like, oh, I don't know. You know, we're thinking about this. Well, it's not really a business, but I'm just going to pitch it because I believe that I know sort of where the market is going. And so what do you think it is, because you deal with so many entrepreneurs that have that kind of foresight and intuition? Because everyone goes like, oh, you know, you could say, you know, Evan Williams for Twitter or Mark Benioff for Salesforce or Elon Musk for, you know, multiple things or Jeff Bezos, or you could rattle them off, but it is such a minority.
Oh yeah. I think that most people, you know, when we're kids, we play around and we do different things and we make a cardboard box into a spaceship and pretend we're astronauts and stuff like that. But then over time we get a lot of that stuff conditioned out of us. You know, we go to school and we succeed by giving answers to the questions that the teachers want to hear, that have already been discovered. And we start to succeed by performing conventionally well within the current status dominance hierarchy, right? We try to get into the top schools. Then after the top schools, we try to go to the top jobs. We try to, you know, have our kids go to the top schools and be in the top country clubs and drive the top cars. And, you know, that ends up being the path that a lot of people get on. And the best founders that I've worked with have this quality of both thinking and acting differently, you know, so the think different part is this idea of coming up with products that seemed inconceivable, that nobody would have imagined could exist, that can't be compared relative to anything that's come before. But the acting differently is pretty interesting too. You know, like the Lyft guys who we worked with, they launched a service in San Francisco that they knew was illegal. And like a lot of people aren't going to do that. So imagine our board meeting, we're sitting there and they're like, we've got this idea. The iPhone 4S came out. That means that we can have peer-to-peer ride sharing. And we're going to have these cars with these pink mustaches. We've tested it. People like it. And so we want to launch this thing. And my partner, Ann, who was on the board of Lyft at the time, says, okay, well, do you have any concerns? They said, well, our only concern is it's illegal. And Ann's like, do you mean legally ambiguous or like just straight up in your face illegal? They're like, oh no, it is unambiguously illegal. And Ann's like, okay, well, do you think it's going to rock people's world? And Logan, who's usually the more understated of the two founders between Logan and John, says, I've never been more certain of anything. And so Ann's like, okay, well, I guess we'll just have to try to help get the law changed. And so they launched this illegal service in San Francisco. And, you know, you think about it, what choice did they really have? If you go to the government of San Francisco and say, hey, is it okay if we launch this cool service? People are going to love it. They're going to say no. And so the only way the service is going to happen and the mission will be fulfilled is if when you're negotiating with the government of San Francisco, it's under the guise of them having to take something away from their citizens that they really like. And so we knew we had to launch it, but that takes some guts, right? Not everybody's willing to launch an illegal service. It embraces a level of sort of disagreeableness. And so, you know, these great startup ideas fundamentally are a disagreement with the present, and the present's going to fight back, and it's not going to fight back fair, right? The taxi lobby wasn't interested in negotiating a win-win with the ride-sharing companies, right? And so you got to decide, we win, they lose. And you're going to have to do some things to break some glass and, you know, get in trouble from time to time. And so that's the other thing I've seen in these founders is a willingness to do that and a thick enough skin to survive the inevitable criticism and the inevitable, you know, kind of judgment that's going to come their way when they try those things.
Well, and the inevitable 99 fail, one might make it, right? Or 900 fail and, you know, or 999,000 fail and one make, I mean, you know what I'm saying? Like, yeah, it's just, yeah, the odds are really against you. But, you know, if you were to say, I'd love your take on kind of this intrapreneurial, like, so I work somewhere, I see something in the business, I have an idea how to make it better, faster, more efficient, whatever terms you want to use, or you're running a division of a business where you work and, you know, being that intrapreneur versus like, just, I'll just take me for example, like, you know, leaving Salesforce and sort of worked on my own for a year and everyone was like, oh, you can do this. And it wasn't that I didn't think I could do it. It was that, do I want to do it? Mm-hmm. Am I inspired and motivated to work by myself? And after about a year, I realized that it wasn't about, could I make it work? I could. But was I enjoying it as much as I did when I was internal? And the answer was no. So, you know, I moved to get back internal with something else. But, you know, ultimately, if you like the security of working somewhere, but you want to have that opportunity to be an entrepreneur, any suggestions to people listening?
For sure. One thing that I've noticed about big companies is like sometimes the startups will say, you know, these big companies can't innovate as fast as we are. They're not as smart. They're bureaucratic, all this stuff. I think that that's a little bit unfair. I think that the biggest difference I've observed is the difference in risk profiles. So like in a big company, once it's visible to the CEO, it's a career limiting move if you fail. And startups don't think that way. If we go back to the Twitter example, Twitter didn't launch something and say, hey, this is Twitter, we hope you like it. It was like a side hustle inside of Odeo. It was almost an accident. They weren't attached to whether it succeeded or failed. They're just trying things, and if it works, we'll do more of it. If it doesn't work, we'll stop doing it. And so, you know, they were not attached to success as the avoidance of failure. It was like trying new experiments until something caught on. So back to intrapreneurship in corporations, too many times I'll see somebody say, we've got this startup initiative within our big company and it's got the visibility of the CEO. We've done a hackathon, we've done a demo in front of the board of directors, and we need to do those things because we need to be serious about, you know, leaping ahead and being pattern breakers in our company. And I'm like, oh no, that's not good. Because what you want to do, what I've seen good companies do, or successful entrepreneurs, they innovate under the cover of darkness. They try a bunch of things. It's like a little kid playing soccer, just kicking the ball around without a particular attachment to where the ball's going to go next. And only after it succeeded. So like I was working with one startup and they were selling to the chief legal officer of a company. And the chief legal officer was trying this AI software to automate legal expenses. And the first things they tried didn't work very well. But then one thing they tried worked 50 times better than their current strategy. So then and only then did this chief legal officer go to the AI czar at the company and say, look at this. And the AI czar needs to put some points on the board. They go to the CEO. They're like, check this out. That is more like what I see happening. And so, but like what would have been a mistake would have been to make it this visible, funded, highly visible initiative. And now all of a sudden, the first thing they try that doesn't work, they're like, oh, we tried that. It didn't work. You only want, I believe, to expose these intrapreneurial things up the chain after you have clear evidence of it working early. Because if you don't, you're going to screw up the risk profile, right? You want to be able to innovate in a sandbox when the penalties for failure are near zero, because that's what startups do, right? And if the penalties for failure are, this is a career limiting move, you'll never take the risks that are necessary to take, right? You know, in the end, business is all about getting paid for the risk you take. And so you've got to take enough risk to have the payoff be there. Most people want to have the big payoff. They don't want to take the risk associated with getting the payoff. And so you have to create the conditions where you can take that risk.
Well, and I think, you know, a couple of things. If you're listening to this and you're like, oh, I have this idea, that's a great way to do it, right? Find a solution, develop a solution, bring it to somebody, you know, show sort of the thoughtfulness and like, what's the worst that can happen? They sort of say no, which, okay, then you course correct or you try again. And hopefully it's a manager that would support the, you know, the chutzpah that you have, right? And say, that's great, but maybe we could do this, this, and this, and you find an ally in that journey that you're going on. If you're thinking that you're going to, you know, start something from scratch, you know, I think it requires reckless optimism, as Mike likes to say, right? And being able to understand patterns and where the market is going, thinking about those first principles, jobs to be done. I mean, really leaning into what others have proven. And they may not use those terms, but they're definitely using that lens.
Yeah. And I also think that some companies are just more friendly to this than others. And so the companies that I've seen do this the best are those where the C-suite says, we should just allocate a certain amount of our profits to very high risk, high upside experiments. And we're not going to judge it on any one individual experiment. It's a basket of experiments. And this is the important part, right? Strikeouts don't matter, but base hits don't either, right? Because like a base hit that's really risky isn't worth it. And so we're only interested in taking a swing at something that could be a grand slam if it works. And but like you'll never swing at those kinds of pitches in the way you need to swing if you're overly preoccupied with what happens, what's the penalty for striking out. And so like what you want, you know, go hit base hits in the core business, right? But like you want either a strikeout or a grand slam and nothing in between with some of these risky things. And that requires a different orientation, right? It's not just about having a new idea. It's about having a new idea that is going to really move the needle in terms of the core business and really going to move the needle in terms of what this company could become. You know, it's not interesting to take a big risk on something that's just going to have an incremental minor impact.
Well, Mike, this has been a fantastic conversation. I feel like I wish the cup of coffee could go a little longer, but we are out of time. So if all of you are excited by what you've just heard, please pick up a copy of Mike and Peter's new book, Pattern Breakers, Why Some Startups Change the Future. And how else can they keep in touch with you and your work, Mike?
So we have a Substack, patternbreakers.substack.com. And then I'm on Twitter at M2JR.
Well, thank you so much, Mike. Thank you, everybody, for joining us here today on this episode of What's Next. Don't forget to subscribe, leave some feedback, tell your friends, and I'll look forward to you joining us again next time. Thanks, everybody, and have a great rest of your day.